Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Welcome to this week's episode of Money Tree Investing Podcast. We're happy to have you joining us on this exciting show today. My name is Kirk Chisholm and I will be your host. Today we're going to be talking about retirement distribution strategies with Brendan Renfro. Before we start digging into some of these Wall Street secrets and some of these really important topics, especially for you people who are closer to retirement, let's hear from our sponsor. Are you looking for a better way to invest during market turmoil? Consider Betterment. Betterment is a robo-advisor that uses the time-tested principles of modern portfolio theory to help you manage your wealth and reach your financial goals. With Betterment, you don't have to worry about what the market's doing on a day-to-day basis. Instead, Betterment allows you to use the stock market to consistently build wealth. For more information, visit moneytreepodcast.com/Betterment. A lot of investors use Betterment, but it doesn't mean it's the right fit for you. Do your own research. Check out moneytreepodcast.com/Betterment to see if Betterment is the right fit for you. Today, we have Brendan Renfro. Hey, how's it going today, Brendan?
Hey, pretty good, Kirk.
Great, great. Well, welcome to the show. This is going to be an interesting show today, and I think it's probably one of the more numbers-oriented shows than we'll hit today on the show, but I think it's important because I think a lot of people miss the nuance of when you retire of the distribution strategies. So we brought Brendan on because Brendan is a full-time professor at East Texas Baptist, and he's a really interesting guy, so I really want to dig in here to some of this with him. So Brendan, how are you doing today?
Doing great.
Tell us a little bit about your background so we can kind of know where you're coming from with all this.
Yeah, so you kind of hit it there in the intro. I am a full-time professor at East Texas Baptist University. And then I also have a practice that I just started last year doing retirement income planning. And then in the National Guard as well. In fact, when we finish this recording today, I'm off to my two-week annual training for the summer. So got a lot of hats, but I like wearing them all. It's fun.
Nice. Well, it must be kind of take an interesting set of skill sets to both be in the National Guard and be a finance professor, right?
Definitely not very transferable, but again, you know, if you have fun what you're doing, it's manageable, and I do very much enjoy both.
Well, we appreciate your service. Let's talk about the retirement distribution strategy. So what are some ways to think about, you know, once you get closer to or in retirement, at some point, you're going to have to start living off of your assets. So what are some ways to think about retirement distribution strategies?
Yeah, there's a couple of different ways. A lot of them do come down to thinking of your withdrawal as a percentage of the portfolio, right? So you got a certain size of an investment portfolio, and you're going to start taking some percentage distribution from that. Might be a fixed percentage. It might be an initial percentage that you then adjust with inflation or with market return. Or then it might be some type of variable withdrawal based on that initial percentage. So there's a lot of different ways you can kind of split it up. And then another way is to even, you know, think of not really as a percentage of a distribution, but putting it into fixed income and taking what the yield might be from that, kind of a safer, less market-based approach for the very conservative investor.
You know, I've written about this on my website a while back with retirement strategies, but there are different methods that people use to calculate distribution strategies. And maybe you can kind of talk a little bit about what some of those different methods are.
Yeah. So, and we can probably start with even just the most common, I think, for anybody, even not just practitioners, but even the average person out there who's just looking at this for themselves, you'll quickly come across the 4% rule. You take the value of your portfolio, whatever that is, and just very simply 4% of that, you know, it might be what you withdraw in that year. So that's the most common way by far, simply because of its popularity.
Are there other ways that people should consider other than the 4% rule?
There are. And a method that I really like was developed. The guardrail method is the more common verbiage here, but the Guyton-Klinger methodology or the variable withdrawal strategy. So, you know, you take an initial percentage withdrawal, but then that percentage is going to adjust as the portfolio changes in value, you know, and as your retirement rolls along, you're going to start to adjust that withdrawal as the withdrawal kind of slides one way or the other, either up or down. You can adjust that withdrawal to get it back in line.
You're a finance professor, so you're obviously probably pretty good with numbers and finance. But how does somebody like somebody who doesn't have that kind of background, how should they look at this? How does this going to relate to them? Like, what's the best way people can look at this?
Yeah, so I always say start with, if you take, again, the baseline, that 4% rule, it's important to understand kind of the context for that rule, right? So if you just say, when you retire, you can take 4% of your portfolio, you're really kind of making a lot of big assumptions about the applicability of that rule to your situation. So if you go back to the way that rule was constructed, first off, just understand the context of the rule. The rule was developed out of some research a guy named William Bingen did to try to find what's the maximum withdrawal rate based on historical scenarios. So he, you know, kind of did a look back into history and said, what was the maximum withdrawal rate that somebody could have taken given any year of retirement and not risk depleting the portfolio? And I think that's important for a number of reasons, not the least of which, because running out of money in retirement is obviously a very critical issue, right? In fact, it's the number one fear of retirees. A study done within that context of what rate of withdrawal could I have taken and never depleted the portfolio throughout retirement, I think it's a very valuable question to answer.
Yeah, no, I would say outside of eating cat food, I would say definitely running out of money is kind of right up there, which I guess that you can correlate those two. So basically, the way people should look at it is look at 4% of your assets and then take a distribution or live off of 4% of your assets. Is that kind of how they look at it?
Yep. So that's the rule in a nutshell. You know, so if you've got $500,000 in a portfolio, you know, and you're retiring today, the 4% rule suggests, okay, you can take $20,000 from that portfolio this year, that first year that you retire. And that's where, and again, I don't want to dig too deep into the numbers here and bore the listeners, but that's where I think it's important to kind of go beyond that simple statement and understand kind of the parameters around the 4% rule. So obviously, there's a lot of factors that are at play when someone's retired and looking to withdraw money from a portfolio, right? We have asset allocation issues. How's your money invested? Do you have that entire $500,000 in CDs down at the bank? Do you have the entirety of that money, you know, in an S&P 500 index? Or is it some blend in between? I think even for the average listener, those differences are pretty obvious, right? So the sustainability of a portfolio invested in such dramatically different fashions is clearly going to be different. So I think it's important to understand then, well, you know, what asset allocation was used in devising that 4% withdrawal. Bingen tested this against a pretty broad variety of asset allocations. And what he found was that generally a portfolio from anywhere between 50% equity and the rest in bonds to 75% stock and the rest bonds, that was kind of the sweet spot. You know, you start to go above 75% stock, well, now you're increasing the risk and variability of the portfolio. You can put the withdrawal right there at risk. But then if you drop below 50, you start to increase the odds that you deplete your portfolio as well, because, you know, you don't have the return to sustain withdrawals over a retirement. So it's really important, I think, to understand, right? Because it should be on your mind if you are thinking about your asset allocation as you retire. I think you definitely need to keep that in mind, what type of security you want in terms of the ability to sustain withdrawals from that portfolio.
Yeah, and that's an interesting point, because anytime that I look at things, anything related to investments and finance, you always have to check your assumptions. So, you know, a lot of people in our industry talk about the 4% rule and they look at it and say, well, I can just take out 4% and they stop there. And what you're talking about is assessing the assumptions, which is the allocations of 50 to 75% equities. I would even challenge those to some degree too, because a lot of assumptions are made on historical returns of equities and fixed income historical returns. The problem is for the last, what is it, 30 years or so, or 40 years now, I feel like I'm getting old, the bond market has been in a bull market. And bonds were considered a safe investment and they were considered a low risk investment. But as interest rates start to climb, they're no longer a safe or conservative investment because bonds actually can lose money, right? If interest rates start to go up, bonds can lose value. And I think we've been caught into this down cycle for so long, most people haven't seen a bond environment where it's a bear market. And we have these conversations all the time with boards and other, you know, groups of people that are kind of using historical assumptions. So in some ways, I would even question that. I do think the 4% rule is reasonable, but it's important to understand the underlying assumptions of it, as you were saying.
Yeah, absolutely. And to kind of touch on your point there in terms of investment performance, you know, it's kind of cliche in our industry, right? The past doesn't predict the future statement. And that's certainly the case for someone who's interested in looking more into that, because I think you hit on a very good point. Wade Fowle does a lot of research in retirement income planning, and he has published several studies dealing with valuation in terms of, yeah, here was our historical context, but this historical period is really, you know, the study was done through a pretty unique period in history where, just as you said, we had some pretty abnormal return situations in terms of a global historical context, and that we're, you know, somewhat in a relatively unique time period here with market valuations and then very low fixed income yields. So it definitely presents a unique thought on that idea.
And actually, I had found this data point recently. So I mentioned here, it's actually interesting. So from 1977 to 81, equities declined 8% and bonds declined 36%. From 73 to 74, equities were down 49%, bonds were down 14%. 1946 to 47, equities are down 25 and bonds are down 26. So to kind of keep reiterating this point, because I don't think people really truly understand, like there are points in time where bonds and equities are not necessarily going to offset each other, which is how we historically look at correlations and allocations. Don't always assume that the market's just going to protect you because you have a 60-40 allocation or whatever the allocation you have.
Yeah, no, it's a very good point.
So anything else on that? I want to kind of move on to some other topics, which I think probably might be interesting as well.
Yeah, you know, there are several different issues, but one more that I think will just kind of help paint the picture here without necessarily going into detail on all of the different parameters. One, even think about your retirement length, right? So how long do you plan to be retired? Because that clearly differs for everyone. The 4% rule, you know, when we say, okay, this is the withdrawal rate that did not deplete the portfolio, you know, we have to ask ourselves, well, over what time period, right? Was this 4% withdrawal sustainable for 15 years, 20 years, 40 years? What was the cutoff point? And it was 30 years. I don't think there's anything wrong with that as a baseline assumption. That's going to be a fairly typical retirement length. But if you're in, say, your early 50s, you should likely plan on, unless you have family health or, you know, something telling you that you shouldn't, you should probably plan on maybe a little longer than 30 years. Or if you're 70, good luck, but maybe you don't need to plan for 30 years of a retirement. So again, I think the big picture here is just understand the parameters and make necessary adjustments to get to your situation.
Let's talk a little bit about account sequencing, because we're talking about distributions, but when it gets down to it, people have 401ks, IRAs, HSAs, they've got taxable money, you know, they've got all money all over the place. Social Security income. Can you talk a little bit about account sequencing, like what it means and where people should start considering pulling their money first?
Yeah, sure. Here, what we're talking about is the tax treatment of different investment accounts, right? Traditional account, like you said, you know, 401k, or if you've rolled that over into an IRA, we know that those accounts grow tax deferred, right? The earnings and the contributions, well, I guess rephrase that, contributions, obviously you deduct those from taxes, and then the earnings from them grow tax-free until you withdraw from the portfolio, but then you pay income tax on those distributions. Compare that to a Roth account, you basically reverse that, right? So contributions into a Roth account, they don't reduce your current taxable income, but then whenever you withdraw them, obviously, those come out tax-free, provided they're qualifying distributions. And then you can have even just taxable accounts. So if you've saved money outside of a retirement account, you're saving more than limits on retirement accounts, and so you've got those in taxable accounts, then those are taxed according to the characterization of the account, right? So whether it's a income, you know, so interest payments or dividends, if they're not qualified, then they're taxed as ordinary income. But then you've got capital gains, so long-term and short-term capital gains in those accounts. So there's a lot of diversity in the way these distributions can be taxed.
I also want to kind of touch on another big area is Social Security. I mean, we could probably have a whole show on Social Security, but let's just take it from the basics. So let's say I'm getting close to retirement. How does Social Security income work? How is it taxed? You know, what do people have to do? Like, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Obviously, it's important to consider taxes on your retirement income. So we talked about the different ways accounts can be taxed. And then we will withdraw from those, as you mentioned, account sequencing, right? So taking even just partial distributions from each of those to try to level out your tax bill. But you have to also then account for your Social Security benefits, because those are potentially taxable. I say potentially because also depending on your measure of combined income, they could not be taxable. So you've got these three tiers of taxability. So either none of your benefit is taxable, half of your benefit is taxable, or 85% of your benefit is taxable. So as you're thinking about not only just receiving your Social Security benefit and its taxability, you have to weigh that against too what you're withdrawing from your accounts, because those will affect the level of taxation on your Social Security benefit, which of course, depending on your marginal tax rate, would be the rate at which it's taxed once you consider the amount that is actually taxable. So a lot of tax planning can really help.
So basically what you're saying is the money that's coming out of the retirement accounts is taxed as earned income?
So again, depending on the account, right? So withdrawals from a tax-deferred account, yeah, those would be taxable as ordinary income. Roth is tax-free. But what I'm saying here is distributions from those accounts go into a measure. IRS calls it your combined income, right? You take your income, which includes withdrawals from tax-deferred accounts, add half of your Social Security benefit to that, and then that will allow you to determine based on the brackets what portion of your Social Security benefit becomes taxable, which then, of course, is just, you know, applied to your marginal tax rate.
The things I wonder about are, is Social Security even going to be around when I need it? You know, people who are taking it now are going to be fine, but, you know, I've got another 20, 30 years before I have to start pulling it. So what are your thoughts on Social Security and its solvency?
Yeah, so that's definitely a hot button item. Real easy to get people fired up and motivated about whether or not Social Security will be around. And I like to point people to the numbers, just show them, you know, hey, here's the truth as we know it today. I don't say that to try to gloss over the fact that there is a problem. I think sometimes emotions get the best of us. So the truth as we know it today, in the last report that the trustees put out, I guess first, before we even talk about that, just I think a basic understanding of the way Social Security is funded is important. You hear it phrased, Social Security is going broke or it's bankrupt. And I think that statement is a little bit skewed, because the way Social Security works, it's a pay-as-you-go system, meaning, you know, so I'm relatively young. I'm in my young 30s. I'm paying into Social Security right now, and that money goes to fund current Social Security recipients. Social Security only runs a balance in the trust fund to the extent that current payments into the system are higher than current withdrawals from the system, okay? So when those when that happens, we build up this surplus in the trust fund. And then whenever the opposite is true, as is the case now, and we're withdrawing at a faster rate than we're putting in, then obviously we spend that surplus down. But that surplus is not, and I do want to be real careful because I know this is an emotional topic, that surplus is not, that's not the bread and butter of Social Security, right? It's the current contributions to the system. So the current estimate is that the trust fund will be depleted in 2035. I'm not saying that's okay. You know, I'm just saying it is what it is, right? The truth as we know it today. The estimate that I think needs to follow that up closely, that usually gets dropped in the discussion, is at that point, the current estimate is that the current contributions to Social Security will fund about three quarters of the promised benefit. Again, am I saying, you know, hey, take 75% of your benefit and be okay with that? No, absolutely not. Definitely, let's get in front of this. Let's try to fix it for the long term. But receiving 75% of your benefit is quite a bit different than the message that I think is often received when we hear Social Security is going broke, right? I think that paints an image of there's not going to be a Social Security benefit. And that is just simply not the truth as we know it today. Again, do I think that should alleviate all your concerns? No, let's figure out how to make up that 25%. But again, I think it's important to understand realities as opposed to just emotional responses to things that make good stories in the media.
Yeah, no, I certainly agree. I think it's the emotional hot button stories in the media don't necessarily do anybody any good other than to bring some attention to the topic, which obviously needs to be discussed because it's been put on the back burner for many decades. I think probably what we'll do is probably have a whole separate show on Social Security because it's a really good topic. And I think a lot of people have questions and it's highly complex. So I guess in the interest of time, where can people find more about you, Brendan?
Yeah, sure. Just my website, brendanrenfro.com. You can find out a little bit more about me. And then I do write fairly often. I try to write articles that I think will answer concise questions. So if you want to learn more about retirement income planning, you know, I've got a number of articles up now. And like I said, post new ones pretty regularly.
Now let's move into the panel portion of our show. Now we're going to be talking about retirement distribution strategies. We have a great panel today. Today we have Miranda Marquette. How you doing, Miranda?
Well, you know, there's this Instacart issue, but you know, we're doing okay.
Well, it's good to know that it's nothing more serious than that. The problems of technology in our society. We also have Andy Wang. Andy, hey, how are you today?
Hey, Kirk, I'm doing great.
Good. How's your poison ivy holding up?
My God, everybody knows about my poison ivy. My poison ivy is very itchy, but other than that, I think stabilized. Doesn't seem to be spreading, so I'll take that as good news.
If you don't want people to talk about your poison ivy, don't post about it on Facebook.
Yeah, I'll learn that someday.
It's great for the rest of us stalkers out there to know exactly what's going on in Andy's life.
Well, I just got to say that, you know, I did it because Facebook and social media, it's like a highlight reel. So I tried to keep it real. I said, I have this poison ivy problem. So it's not all sunshine and rainbows.
Nice. So, and today we also have a new panelist, Dustin Heiner. Dustin, how are you today?
I'm doing fantastic. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, great to have you on the show. And we have a great panel to talk about this. And I want to start with Andy. What are your thoughts about kind of retirement distribution strategies? I know you're also a wealth manager and have some experience working with a lot of clients. So what have you seen and what are some of your thoughts on that?
So are we talking about taking distributions once one is in retirement? So is it like at what age one should start?
Well, we can kind of open it up because that's certainly one part of the question is what age should they start? Just thinking about it from a mindset standpoint, because some people look at it from the perspective of when should I retire or what income do I need? So what your thoughts or experiences are when you're talking to clients about the concept of starting to take distributions, when should they retire?
Well, I think it all starts with some basic planning. And unfortunately, finances too often take a back seat just because life gets in the way. I mean, we all get busy. We're raising our families. We're trying to do our jobs at work. And the last thing that you're trying to think about, at best, it's like, okay, I'm going to make some 401k choices in how I'm going to invest my money. But I think that most people or many people aren't sitting down to do the planning. And if you use an analogy that you're going to go on a trip somewhere, if you're going to go on a road trip, right? Back in the day, you would go to AAA and pick up some maps. You don't really need that anymore. We depend on our Waze app to direct us in real time, which is great. But I think with our finances, it does pay to sit down and do some basic planning to figure out, you know, how much money do you think you'll need in retirement? What are your expected monthly and annual expenses? And then you can do some reverse engineering to figure out how long do you need to work and How much do you need to save? How much do your investments need to be growing while you're working and then while you're in retirement? And then you can start making choices as to when you can retire, when you can take distributions, and have a confidence that you'll have enough in retirement and you'll have some certainty.
What about you, Miranda? What are your thoughts on retirement or how you think about it?
Retirement. No, I think Andy really, you know, hit it on the head when he's talking about looking at your own finances, figuring out what's going to work for you. I think a lot of the time, you know, we get caught up in like this arbitrary number. Well, we need $1 million to retire. Well, why? Why do you need $1 million to retire? Well, because they said we need $1 million to retire. But have you actually looked at your needs? Have you actually looked at how you're going about it? And maybe you do need $1 million to retire. Maybe you need more than $1 million to retire. And maybe retirement for you looks completely different. You know, I talk a lot about how I like what I'm doing. I like writing. I like doing my thing. And even though I'm setting money aside in tax-advantaged retirement accounts, I also don't see myself like aiming to retire from my life because I like the life I live.
Yeah, and that's really important. I think a lot of people, when they think about retiring, they're thinking about just moving off into the sunset and just cutting the cord and just starting their retirement. They don't think about it beyond that. Whereas some people want to work forever because they just love what they do. So that's, I really appreciate that perspective. And I think more people need to think about that in their retirement strategies. What about you, Dustin? What's your mindset when you're thinking about retirement?
When I think about retirement, actually, it started back when I was like 13 years old. I just hated working for other people. So I had a paper route. I was delivering newspapers. So I always got entrepreneurial. Then I got a job. And then people were telling me I had to focus on retirement. But I thought, I'm an investor. I invest in rental properties, like specifically rental properties. I don't flip any properties. And I thought, why do I want to retire at 60? So I started investing in rental properties and I quit my job or I retired when I was 37 years old. And so I literally cashed out my 401k. I'm not saying everybody should do this. It's more of an advanced strategy. Cashed out my 401k, IRA, took all my savings, bought one rental property, then saved all that money, then bought another property. So my perspective with retirement was I wanted my money now. So I needed to have income coming in every single month so I can retire. So now, fast forward, I have 30 plus properties that make me a good amount of money. And I don't have to worry about saving a big nest egg and then hope it doesn't run out. So I made a different shift because I was always on like, I want to save money. I want to put it away, put it in stocks, which I had plenty of that. But then I realized how much money I'm making rental properties. And I just kept buying and buying. And when I was 37 years old, I quit my job and I literally never work a job again. So I have a whole huge different shift in perspective that really helped me to get to where I now don't have to work.
And I love that perspective because I think we have a lot of listeners to the show who are real estate investors. And it's a very different perspective in the sense that, you know, many of them they're not employed or in some cases they're unemployable now because they've been real estate investors so long. You know, it's like running a business, but you know, you don't have to go to work every day. You don't have to, you know, worry about the same things that other people have to worry about because you're effectively, you've got this passive income stream. So I love that perspective. And, you know, have you thought about how you're going to, what you're going to do in retirement? Are you going to change that? Or are you just going to continue on your path?
So I guess a couple of things. Well, I love passive income. I love making money without working. It's just absolutely amazing. You know, all of a sudden, hey, there's a check from this property manager or hey, there's a check from this other property manager. Well, I literally only work 30 minutes a month on my real estate and it makes money all the time. So when I'm thinking about retirement, I really, when I told people that I retired early when I was 37 years old, people said, well, what are you going to do with your life? I mean, there's so much to do. I know you can travel and stuff, but don't you feel like antsy? You got to do something. And I said, absolutely. Like I try to use more of the term I'm financially independent. So I quit my job and now, all of my retirement, basically, you know, post career, I basically try to serve people. And so that's what I do now is I currently teach people how to invest in real estate because I love it. I have so much passion for it. And as I was quitting my job, I had so many people telling or asking me, how do you do it and how can I do it? So I started helping people. And so that's what I do now. It's more because I have time, I have money, and now I've been blessed to be able to have this lifestyle. Now I just try to teach as many people as possible how to do it.
That's awesome. I really appreciate that because I think there's a lot of successful people out there who don't, and they're not really kind of giving back to the community at large, if you will. And that I'm sure you're able to help a lot of people, and that's great. So I want to talk a little bit about the retirement crisis there. I know the GAO put out a report a few years back, I think it was like 4 years ago, that really talked about that most households approaching retirement have very low savings. Or in the case of one of the points, Americans between 55 and 64, 41% of them have zero savings. Not very little, zero. They have no money saved for retirement. You know, that's a scary concept if you think about it, because close to half the population has no savings. They're living off of Social Security, which, you know, you can always find parts of the country where that's feasible. But it's also going to be challenging for a lot of people to have an enjoyable retirement. So what are some ways that people can actually prevent that from happening to themselves? Or what if they get into a position if they have very little retirement savings and they're worried about it or they don't have enough? How do they deal with that? What are your thoughts, Andy?
Well, it's called a crisis for a reason. Before I answer that, kudos to Dustin for financial freedom. And when I talked earlier about the planning and needing to sort of navigate and map out your plan, I mean, part of that is like the financial independence, retire early movement is kind of redefining. There are those who are deciding that maybe they don't need to spend that much in retirement and therefore they can retire early. And then the flip side of that is maybe your goals are that you want to go cruising all the time. You want to have a legacy and you want to be able to support your grandkids' college tuitions, which who knows how much that will cost. That thought frightens me. But for those who don't have enough, I mean, time is your friend. So before we get to what to do when you're late to the game, let me encourage those who are not late yet. I mean, you got to get started now. The earlier, the better. Your money has two best friends. It's time and compound growth. So the earlier you start investing in your 401k, your retirement accounts, your non-retirement accounts, that will grow and will be able to support you in retirement. I think that the later that you are in the game, it gets a little bit tougher. You have to make some tougher decisions because you need to decide how much risk are you willing to take with that shorter investment sort of runway. And I think that has to be mapped out carefully, because then timing does become important. If you are trying to jump in and make some last minute attempt to grow your nest egg, if your timing is off, you know, that can really set you back. So I think it takes some care in planning, but hopefully you don't get there. Hopefully you get started early.
Andy, I completely agree with you. I think it's a Chinese proverb. It's, when is the best time to plant a tree? Well, it was 20 years ago. Obviously, we know that it's going to be big by now. The next best time, the second best time is today. And so really just starting today in planning, in starting to save and starting to change your life and make it doesn't have to be necessarily drastic cuts, but really just one step at a time. You know, a journey of 1,000 or a million miles starts with one step. Just take that one first step so you can get going. Because if you don't save any money at all, just try 1% of your income, just literally 1% or even 0.5% or even just $30 or something like that. Just start doing that. And as you do that, you realize, hey, I didn't really need that $30. It's gone. It's already in my savings account ready for investing. And then maybe you can up it to 50, and then maybe you could up it to 100, like a month. And so I would say, time is definitely your friend, but right now is the best time to get started and start making as gradual steps, like baby steps as possible, and then move into bigger steps.
Yeah. And I think that's a great point, because I think a lot of people get stuck in the rut of thinking like, well, I don't have enough money. I can't save for tomorrow if I can't have enough for today. You know, the costs of everything are going up. And as Andy said, the cost of college, I don't want to think about that either. That's kind of blowing my mind. Just thinking about, you know, inflation rate is 2% or less, and college inflation rate is like, you know, 7-8% a year. So it's kind of nuts to think about. Miranda, what are your thoughts on the, you know, on this, on the crisis and how people can deal with that?
Yeah, well, I think as I talk about a lot, I mean, one of the first things you have to do is take a step back and consider your values and priorities. So I loved what Dustin was saying, like, well, I wanted my money now and I wanted to do, you know, so we found a way to make that happen. And he did what he needed to do. You know, I look at my own situation and I'm like, I'm a freelancer. So I decide who my clients are. I take on the work I want to take on. And I say no to work I don't want to do, you know, and I'm happy doing the freelance writing and making a little bit of money off my blog. And And it allows me to live a lifestyle that I enjoy and that I want to live. And so I think one of the first things we have to do is take a step back and say, okay, what are my priorities here? And what am I trying to accomplish? Because a lot of the time we separate our money from what we're doing in our lives. And we don't think about how your life affects your money and how your money affects your life. We don't think about that a lot. And we don't think about like, well, what am I using this money for? And we don't really consciously think about where the money is going. I remember 10 years ago, I was sitting around going, why don't I have enough money to travel? Why don't I have enough money to do this? Why don't I have enough money to do that? Like, I'm doing everything I'm supposed to do. And then I looked around and realized I had a whole bunch of like a pile of trinkets and a bunch of stuff I didn't care about. And I was like, and I added it all up and I'm like, oh, okay. That's like 2 trips to Europe or 3 trips to South America. Like I added all of that up and realized that I hadn't been making a plan. Now, if you are 50 years old and you've saved absolutely nothing for retirement up to this point, making a plan now will probably help you a little bit, but you're not going to, you know, unless you do something really drastic, you're not going to like retire in 5 years. But, you know, speaking to people who are a little bit younger, who have a stretch of time ahead of them, have time to adjust course, like really honestly taking a step back and saying, okay, what do I want my money to do for me? And what steps can I take to make that happen? And it doesn't happen overnight and it doesn't happen immediately. But when you start looking at your money as a tool and a resource and intentionally deciding what to do about it and how it's going to work for you, it really makes a difference in how you move forward and the decisions you make and the things that you prioritize.
I've found that also for older investors, I have a lot of students that are older as well that want to start investing in real estate. Some that are like 55, they say, hey, Dustin, am I too late? I'm like, it's never too late. And really what it comes down to, in my opinion, when you're going to retire, it's all about money coming in that is going to, and obviously the money that you saved is really going to help you for the long haul. But if you have more money coming in without you even working, like if you write a book and it becomes a best-selling book, it just keeps selling. That's passive income. That's money coming in without you doing something. And so that's another thing, like absolutely save and invest it, but try to figure out other ways to make money. And that's how I don't have to work, is because I have passive income coming in. And so if you just imagine if you had at 65 years old, you know, income starting to run out, or 70 years old, and you have to maybe go get a job at Walmart, just being a greeter or something. Well, it'd be better if you had bought a property when you're 50 that was making you $250 a month, and then maybe bought two or three more. Then you got an extra $1,000 coming in. So just think of other ways to make money come in without you working. That's what really helps me and all the people, the investors that I work with, is just, let's just get a few properties and then maybe we can keep rolling that into more properties.
Yeah. And I think that's a great strategy. I know the real estate theme really speaks to a lot of people. And I think if you can find properties that are paying income. And what part of the country are you living in right now, Dustin?
I love that question. So the Midwest is really, really good. So I lived in California in 2000, or my whole life, but in 2006, I realized I want to start investing. And it was crazy high in California, but without knowing how to do it, I just flew out to Ohio. I found a property in Ohio. And long story short, I flew out to Ohio, bought a property, flew back, got a property manager, did everything wrong. Like I lost tens of thousands of dollars doing it wrong. But since then, after, you know, 12 plus years, 13 years of investing, I figured out a way to actually do it right. And so Midwest, even getting down to like North and South Carolina, down into Florida has some good parts. But if you go along the West Coast, really, really expensive. Even in Arizona, starting to get expensive. That's where I currently live now. New York's really expensive. But if you look in the Midwest, like Indiana, Indianapolis, Kentucky, North Carolina, South Carolina, down in Florida, those are, and here's a big thing. A lot of people say, and I don't like the term location, location, location when it comes to real estate. And the big reason why is I'm not leaving there. Somebody else will live there as long as I have a good property. And I make sure that's taken care of. And I don't over exorbitantly charge somebody. I just charge, you know, just a little below market rents. It stays rented. Everybody needs a place to rent. And so Midwest, there are people that live there, you know, we kind of fly over them. There are people that live there and it's a great way to make money. And you're benefiting them because they can't buy a house. You're helping them by giving affordable housing.
Yeah, that's great. There's, for the real estate investor type, which there are quite a few listening to this show, it's a great dynamic. I think the challenge is for people who are not real estate investors, how do they kind of overcome this when they don't have the kind of time to do that? I mean, how much time do you spend on your real estate?
So the easiest part is buying the property. Like you could just say, I'm going to go just find it on Zillow, Indianapolis, get a realtor and buy the property. That's the easiest part. The harder part is setting up the business first so that it runs itself. So I have 30 plus properties, but I literally don't do any work. All of my property managers do all the work for me and I just get a check. So it's the 30 minutes is just getting their statements, looking at it, make sure they're not, you know, there's nothing wrong or anything. And then I put it away and I have all the rest of my life to do whatever I want. So setting up the business does take time because you got to find property managers, realtors, contractors, wholesalers, roofers, plumbers. You have to build the business to make it run itself. And then you put a piece of inventory, which is your property. Imagine you have a convenience store. You're starting a convenience store from scratch. Well, you got to get the walk-in coolers that help hold the cold drinks. You got to get the gondolas to hold the inventory for the candy bars, cash registers, bank account, set up your business, you know, the LLC or whatever. And then after that's all done, that's when you put your inventory, like that one candy bar, into the business. And that's what I do with all my students is I help them build the entire business first. I say, wait on the property, make sure it's a good area, build the business first. And then once the business is ready, we get that piece of inventory and we put it in. And then you get the second piece of inventory, you just keep putting it in. So it does take time. If I can quantitate the hours, I can't actually do that just because each scenario is different. But usually I would say after a student starts working with me, usually within the first month, they have a good general business plan and business set up. And then I work with them even further to find the right properties and screen them and make sure it's going to be making enough money and everything like that.
I love the way you kind of look at it because I've actually not heard anyone else in the real estate investor field describe it that way. So I think that's great. And I appreciate that because most people just say, I'll go out and buy it. Property and figure it out. And you're saying actually build the infrastructure first and then buy it. So I actually really like that approach. Let's talk a little bit about some of the bigger mistakes that people make when they're looking at retirement distribution strategies. Miranda, in your experience, what are some of the biggest mistakes that people make?
Well, I think a lot of the time people don't sit down and look at all of the distribution and, you know, how does this work with my tax situation? So, and my Social Security situation, you know, figuring out when to start taking Social Security, figuring out, okay, if I have a Roth account versus another type of account, how does this interact with my RMDs from my traditional accounts? Like, how does this all work together? What do I need to know? And how is Social Security fit into this? And so I think it's really important to sit down with a retirement specialist and kind of hammer all of this out and kind of plan it out. You know, do I think I might go back to work? I mean, my dad recently, he retired a couple years ago. You know, they asked him to come back last year in a consulting capacity and he didn't need the money, but he thought, you know, give me something to do. I mean, my mom hasn't tired of teaching yet. So he went ahead and said he'd do this consulting work. He picks his hours, all that good stuff. But, you know, when he went back, he didn't factor into the fact that he had been taking some Social Security and now he had to pay back some of the Social Security because he was working now. And so things like that are really important to sit down with a retirement planning specialist, somebody who really knows Social Security, who really understands withdrawal, and really can sit down with you and say, all right, what's the best strategy here to minimize your tax bill while at the same time making sure you get the money you need?
Great. What about you, Andy? What are some of the biggest mistakes that you've seen people make with their retirement strategies?
Well, I had mentioned college tuitions. That's my specter in the near future. But for retirees, I think it's really underestimating medical expenses. There have been a number of surveys that show that 90% of respondents have no idea what their future medical costs might be, how to estimate them. And it's also a very high percentage that say that they do not have a strategy for paying for post-retirement medical costs. So it's something that one should think about. According to Fidelity, estimated additional medical costs in retirement could add up to $200,000 for the average person. So we're not talking about a small number. It's a significant number. So if you're still working, you know, think about taking advantage of a health savings account and putting aside tax-deferred money toward your healthcare savings. And then for those who are closer to retirement, I'm a fee-only advisor, so I don't get involved in insurance, but in doing some planning, it may be worth looking at a supplemental health insurance plan to fill the gap and also to take a look at long-term care insurance to see if that makes sense.
So, I mean, you make a great point about the medical costs. What are your thoughts on long-term care? I don't know if you have thoughts on this, because I know that there's some, the trend, at least here in Massachusetts, is costs are going up and a lot of the carriers are leaving the state. And, you know, I know many of this is state by state, but, you know, are you seeing that as a viable strategy kind of longer term?
Well, as I said, not an insurance person, so it's not my area of expertise. We usually, you know, we'll partner with other experts in that area on behalf of our clients to take a look. It is unique to the individual. They'll take a look, see what are their savings, what are their options when thinking about long-term care, because even the long-term care insurance products, they can be quite expensive as well.
Yeah, I've seen that too. I've always been a little hesitant to look at long-term care the way that I've also, I'm not an insurance person, but my kind of the rules of thumb I've been told are, or, you know, if you have within a small sliver of asset amounts, then it really makes sense. But if you have too much or too little, then it doesn't make sense from a numbers standpoint. But you make a great point about the medical expenses, because let me ask you this, Andy. How do you said it's hard to kind of estimate, like, how do you estimate medical expense, or how do you kind of walk people through that part?
Well, I think it's just something that people need to think about. It's something that, it's another one of those items that people think, oh, it's not going to happen to me, so you don't address it. And it's just, it's like a budget item that you want to have in your mind and as part of your plan, so that, you know, as you get older, the expectation is that medical expenses are not getting cheaper, so that you do need to account for that. And some of that may come at the expense of spending a little bit less, right? I mean, just really adjusting your budget in retirement. One other thing is that I think many people also overestimate Medicare benefits. So that's something to look at too, just when you're calculating all your numbers in your balance sheet.
Dustin, what about you? What are some of the biggest mistakes you've seen people make?
I think it comes down, I'm seeing it with my parents and then my wife's parents, I've seen it play out like this. But just imagine you have a 5-gallon jug and you work your entire life to fill up that jug, which is a good, noble, and great to fill it up. But imagine putting a pinhole at the bottom. That's when you start taking it out. And then the pinhole gets a little bigger, but let's say it starts to drain out the water. Well, if you don't have anything filling the, like just a little bit, trying to make that bucket stay full, it's eventually going to run out. And so like my in-laws right now, they don't have any, other than Social Security, they don't have any money coming in. So they're really worried. If they just had one property that just put a little bit of money into that bucket or a little bit of water into that bucket, it would stave off that day that they run out just a little bit longer. And if they had that property and then maybe they say they bought it 20 years ago and they're like, you know what, we need money now. That $200,000, like Andy said, that sounds daunting. But if they had a house they bought for $50,000 back 20 years ago, or even they bought it for $100,000 10 years ago, that they can maybe sell it for $200,000 or $250,000. That's $100,000 or $150,000 that they can use to help pay for that. And it wouldn't your kids wouldn't have to shoulder the burden. So I just think a big mistake is not figuring out a way to put a little bit into that bucket, so it at best, you know, keeps it from draining out sooner. But if at worst, it doesn't drain out as soon as it can. But at best, it's filling it up a little bit. So that's what I would like to see, is see people start putting things, water, or filling up their bucket from the top, as opposed to just all of it coming out the bottom.
Let's have some final thoughts here, and then we can kind of wrap up. Andy, what are some of your final thoughts, and where can people find more about you?
My final thoughts are that I'm very impressed that Dustin out-Chinesed me with the Chinese proverb. I'm still trying to get over that.
Thank you for asking. It's not too late, Andy. It's not too late.
I'm going to come back next time with like 5 Chinese proverbs. Every answer will be a Chinese proverb. So listeners can find me at runnymede.com, where we are fee-only financial advisors. You can also catch me at inspiredmoney.fm, a podcast that I host where we really try to put a positive spin and interesting guests talking about money. Please find me there.
Awesome. And what about you, Dustin? What are your final thoughts, and where can people find more about you?
Yeah. So one thing that comes in my brain is my children and leaving a legacy for them. You're going to hear me speak a lot about real estate, and real estate, I could pass down the real estate to them. It's generational wealth. But outside of that, what really I'd like to leave everybody with is our next generation. We need to be teaching them not to fall in the things that we fell into. And so teaching your kids, or if you have grandkids, encouraging them to go in a direction of saving. I was never taught to save. And so what I do with my kids is, like, let's say they make $10, you know, from their birthday. Well, 10% goes to charity, or we give it to church and give it to God. So we're teaching them tithing from the break, just giving back initially. And then 50% of the whole goes into savings. You know, they don't need the money, but I'm instilling that idea of saving. And now they have bank accounts that have, you know, $500-$600 in there. And they're like, wow, we got 20 cents in interest. And so that's, I'm building that in, you know, they're like 10, 8, and 6, and 4. And so that's something that I do. And then also 20% goes to mommy, because they need to know about responsibilities, paying for lights, food, and bed sheets, and all that good stuff. And so we are trying, I'm trying to instill in them from the very, very beginning that money is something that we need to look at with responsibility. But yeah, so that's what I would like to leave a legacy with my family, so that it passes down. But yeah, so I have a blog or a website and a podcast. It's the Master Passive Income Podcast, where I talk only about rental properties, not flipping, wholesaling, or anything else. It's just rental properties. So I'm really passionate about it. And masterpassiveincome.com is my site, where you can go and see everything that I have, all the articles and everything else, and get a hold of me there as well.
Great. Well, thanks for coming on, Dustin. We really valued your contribution today from a completely different perspective than the rest of us have. Miranda, what are your final thoughts, and where can people find more about you?
Yeah, so you can always head on over to MirandaMarkwood.com. I have some resources that show the apps and the strategies I use to live the lifestyle I want with my own money. And really, honestly, I mean, I think it just goes back to looking at your financial resources as, you know, resources, things you can direct, and understanding like how to use that, whether you do real estate like Dustin, whether you have some other strategy in mind, just looking at your money as a resource and figuring out how you want it to work for you is a really big thing, because until you make that mindset shift, it's going to be very difficult to see money more as like your tool that helps you build the life you want.
Great. And my name's Kirk Chisholm, Wealth Manager of Innovative Advisory Group. We don't just manage your wealth, we make your life better. You can find about more about me at innovativewealth.com, and certainly on the show every week. So thank you all for joining us for the show on Money Tree Investing Podcast. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or Google Play. You can check out the show at moneytreepodcast.com. On our website, you'll have access to all our resources, show notes, as well as the archive shows. Lastly, please leave a show rating and comments on the podcast app of your choice. When you subscribe and rate the show, it allows us to get access to some of the better guests and some of the top guests that you really want to hear. I know a bunch of you have been sending in requests for guests, which has been great. And we've got a number of great guests lined up for the next few months. So I know you're all going to be pretty excited about that. So have a great week ahead. And remember, no one will care about your money like you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.